Thanks for being here. I'm still trying to figure out what my role is in this group a little bit, but the title's a little bit awkward. What I'm really going to do is give you a history lesson for tomato. And so it's a very different crop from some of what we've been talking about, and it has a long history of using crop wild relatives for improvement. Speaking at this meeting, I'm a little afraid that some of what I'm going to say is counter to what other speakers would have said, and that, especially since some of us may be in a bad mood, I may be the subject of some ridicule and derision. I just hope that the tomatoes you throw are soft. Because of time, I want to go ahead and start with the conclusions, and that way I can fly through the rest very rapidly. So as I mentioned, crop wild relatives have been intentionally used to improve cultivated tomato for nearly 100 years. So the first reference that I found is a 1920 reference in a USDA report that cites work that was done several years previously. So we're almost reaching sort of the 100-year anniversary of documented use of wild relatives to improve cultivated tomato. Currently, the go-to source for new variation are wild relatives and accessions that you would find in the Tomato Genetics Resource Center, the TGRC at UC Davis, or the National Plant Germplasm System. And in fact, most international collections have simply renamed varieties that are in the TGRC that were, or accessions that are in the TGRC that were collected by Charlie Rick. I am going to touch a little bit on past systems of cooperative phenotyping that was sort of a key to promoting the use of these wild relatives, and I'm going to suggest that maybe that system is now broken, and we can learn from the past and perhaps improve future activities by learning from the past. The other thing that I really want to emphasize is that new variation is best revealed through crossing, actual population development. Association analysis within germplasm collections is not sufficient to reveal that useful variation. And then finally, in tomato, contemporary varieties actually have more genetic variation than landrace, vintage, or heirloom varieties, or populations, if you want to call them that. This increased variation tends to surround introgressions that have been brought in for improved fruit quality, changes in plant habit, and disease resistance traits. Okay, but I look at tomato as a success story. You know, when people say that we have to worry about genetic variation in our crops, in fact, tomato that we grow today has more genetic variation than the tomato that we grew 50 years ago, and certainly more than the tomato that we grew 100 years ago. Okay, so one can't talk about the use of crop wild relatives in tomato without mentioning Charlie Rick. So you already saw in the first presentation, in Candy Gardner's presentation, a picture of Charlie. Here's another one. And what I like about the picture that Candy showed in this one is it shows Charlie making crosses. Okay. The diagram here in the center are the crossing relationships that Charlie worked out for tomato and the wild relatives. And so, back up here. I'm going to concentrate on the red-fruited clade, which is down here, but you need to know that there are a number of green-fruited species that are sexually compatible with cultivated tomato and can be accessed through crossing, and in fact have been. Okay. And just as a reminder, the center of origin and diversity for tomato is in Andean South America. Recent study, cooperative study, suggested that the original domestication event probably occurred in the region of the border between Peru and Ecuador, and then there was a secondary domestication event in the Yucatan. Okay, so this is what the wild, or the genetic resources look like. So you can see there's a lot of variation in fruit, shape, size, color. And for the first example, I'm going to concentrate on the wild relative that you see in the upper corner here, Solanum pimpinellifolium. The habitat of this are the mountain valleys of the Andes. These mountains create a barrier to movement. And so if you look at the Pimpinella foliums from a genetic perspective, so I'm showing kind of the range here. You can see that there are coastal accessions and there are mountain accessions. And in this panel A, what I'm showing you is principal components analysis based on SNP data that shows that these populations are actually genetically distinct in many cases. And there are actually some genes that may enforce that distinctness, but that's the topic of another presentation. And importantly, the Solanum pimpinellifolium accessions have been very useful for introducing bacterial resistance into the cultivated species. And so that would be resistance to Xanthomonas species as well as Pseudomonas species. And this is resistance that is now out there and deployed that was completely absent from early domesticates and land-raised varieties. Moving on, I'm just going to mention something about the populations that are found on the Galapagos Islands. So there are two species. I think it's open to debate whether these really should be considered distinct species, but that's what the taxonomists are telling us for now. These have been a source of high beta carotene, potential source of drought tolerance, potential source of salt tolerance, and very importantly, the source of the jointless pedicel, which is in virtually all processing tomato varieties and has helped facilitate mechanization of your ketchup and salsa type tomatoes. And that example is shown here. So you see this accession with a jointless pedicel. You see that same gene is here in a processing type, and it permits mechanical harvest as well as some mechanization further down the pipeline. Okay, and I think that we are all aware that both agriculture and industrialization are threatening some of the crop wild relatives. So these are two pictures that were taken by Roger Chatelet when he went back to make some recollections of populations that Charlie Rick had made. And it's important to note that many of the populations that are in the TGRC now are in fact absent in the wild. So LA716, a very important Solanum pinellii accession, is now basically a parking lot. Okay. And then in the Atacama Desert, mining activities and grazing activities are also affecting these wild populations. And this sheep here is actually grazing on Solanum sitiens. Okay. And so the source of traits now are really these germplasm centers, and both the TGRC and the National Plant Germplasm System. This is just a picture that I took off of a pamphlet that I have in my office, Disease Resistance in the Wild Species of Tomato. It's a report of the National Screening Committee. It was led by Leonard Alexander at the institute where I work. And I think that this, for me, this was impressive because this publication, it's essentially a USDA pamphlet. There are over 20 cooperators, and they systematically worked through the wild species, each cooperator screening the populations for a disease or diseases that they were experts in. Okay, this work was done in the early 1950s. Okay, so this is table 11, and it's showing the screening that Leonard Alexander did for resistance to tomato mosaic virus. Okay, and then next to that is an Ohio report from 1970. Describing the release of some greenhouse tomatoes with the TM2A gene for resistance to this particular disease. So this is the most widely deployed resistance in tomato. It's a single gene, single dominant gene, and it still works. So it's been durable for over 50 years. Okay. And interestingly, this gene to integrate it required embryo rescue. So it's a very early example of biotechnology to help exploit crop wild relatives. Maybe shouldn't be using the word exploit, but to help make the genetics of those wild relatives work for contemporary agriculture. Okay. Another example I'm going to give is the development of the mechanically harvested tomato. So I already mentioned the jointless gene from Solanum galapagense. In developing the processing tomato, we basically took what was a fresh market tomato, changed the plant habit, changed the fruit form in order to facilitate crossing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the signatures of selection that we can find because of this process. And just a couple of points. I've already mentioned a number of the wild species that have contributed to this new market class, as it were. I have a student that will be defending her thesis tomorrow, and one of the things that she did was to mine through 20 years of data from California, from the processing industry there. And she documented that in that 20 years, there has been an average increase in two resistances in the varieties that are used by growers in California. Okay, so that's one new resistance every 10 years. So the process isn't fast, but nonetheless, we can document that there is an increased deployment of new genes from these wild relatives. Okay, so this is really the changes in fruit shape, the loss of the jointed pedicel, small core size of the fruit, have all facilitated mechanization. So on the black and white pictures are showing you how harvest used to be done. So you would have a crew that would go out and hand pick into bushel baskets. Then it would come into a factory where a team of people would hand core. So they'd take sharp knives and cut out the core, and then slice up the tomatoes and put them into a can. This is all done mechanically now, very little labor, from harvest to processing. And again, the genes that allowed this to happen all came from wild species. Okay. And so in this slide, what I'm doing is I'm showing you sort of the three main market classes for tomato. You have the processing tomato, which is a very compact, determinant plant. You have staked fresh market tomatoes, which tend to be determinant but have longer internodes, larger fruit, usually 3 to 4 harvests. And then you have the tomatoes that are grown under protected culture, either hydroponic or in this case in soil, where the harvest may be extended over 9 months. It's a large indeterminate plant. The genes that differentiate these, again, are largely coming from wild species. So all of the changes that we've been talking about, whether it's domestication, I didn't really talk about adaptation to specific environments, but one can find that in genomes as well. The disease resistance and the market differentiation, these all represent genetic changes. Okay, and for the most part, genetic changes that are imparted because of human selection. So in order to investigate some of these changes, we've got a number of tools available to us, and I need to put in a plug for the SOLCAP array. So it's a SNP array that was developed largely through the USDA-funded SOLCAP project, but also in cooperation with Martin Gonnell at Trade Genetics and Matilda Coase at INRA. These two helped us sort through SNPs that were already available on different platforms so that we created a sort of universal platform, as it were. And then Illumina put their industry academic partnership to work to help make this a reality. And so this platform, the SOLCAP Infinium Array, is still sort of the go-to SNP genotyping tool for tomato. The beauty of this array, so it may not be on a per data point basis as inexpensive as sequencing to do SNP genotyping, but the beauty of it is it creates a platform that allows data sets to be merged. And so a number of different groups have been genotyping on this platform and sharing data. So the most recent publication described SNP variation in 1,000 tomato accessions. And that publication helped us sort out where domestication actually occurred, and also helped us understand a lot more about the distribution of genetic variation. And so what we learned about the distribution of genetic variation can be described here. So the panel A is again showing a principal components analysis. This includes the Pimpinella foliums, and you can see that much of the variation on PC1, the first principal component, is due to these black boxes which span here. Okay, so much of that variation across principal component 1 is due to the wild species. And then principal component two in panel A is really looking at the variation within cultivated types. So panel B, redid the analysis without the Pimpinella foliums, and again you can see the distribution of variation. And this, this in a visual way sort of hits home the message that these vintage varieties, so these are older varieties, what some people would call heirloom varieties, have less genetic variation than the processing varieties or the fresh market varieties. And then below is a graph out of analysis with Pritchard's structure, which also indicates that we really have different germplasm pools. Okay, they're distinct populations genetically. I think the main point I wanted to make of this slide, so this is again looking at structure and tying it to pedigrees, is that we can kind of look at the transition from a fresh market type like the C28 to a processing type. Okay, and so that human-driven selection for different market classes can be visualized in the graph from structure. And then another point that I'm just going to hammer home here, so this is a rarefaction analysis. The y-axis is showing polymorphic SNPs. The x-axis is population size, and what this analysis really drives home is this idea that the wild species have more genetic variation. In this case, genetic variation is defined as allelic variation or polymorphic markers. And importantly, the contemporary varieties have more variation than the vintage or heirloom types as well as the landrace types. Okay. Okay, post-genomic era, right? Since 2014, over 400 tomato genomes have been published and are available in public databases. I could probably crank this number up to 500, but the quality of data varies a lot. We've preferred to work with the data coming out of the 150 genome resequencing project, which really amounts to 85 unique genomes, because it's high quality. It's average 16x resequencing. As I talk about this research really quickly, I'm going to have pictures of the students that did the work. So this is Gabriel Abood, who is my bioinformatics point person on this project. He helped us develop pipelines where we could take any gene that we were interested in, and we could easily retrieve either the structural gene, the promoter, or the 3' end, cluster it, and take a look. You basically ask the question, how many alleles are there? And so this is the TM2A gene. I'm going to kind of skip over that because the next slide is going to give us essentially the same thing. If we look at genes that affect fruit quality, in this case beta carotene content, we're seeing essentially the same thing. You can identify the allele that's most common in cultivated material. You can find a few other alleles in cultivated material. A lot of the variation is coming from the green-fruited wild species, and then within that red-fruited clade, you can identify some other allelic variation. For most of the genes that we've worked with, and this includes the entire carotenoid biosynthesis pathway and a number of other pathways that we're interested in, you can find more than 30 alleles in these collections. So there's a lot of allelic diversity, most of which we're not using. The challenge is to figure out which of those alleles is better than the one that we're already using. Okay, and it's a huge challenge because we simply don't have the structure function information to tell us. So the approach that we've taken has been really a breeding approach, and this is showing the work of Caleb Orchard, who was a master's student in my lab, and it basically shows an approach where we take a large segregating population, back cross population. We use a gel assay marker to look for the heterozygotes at the particular gene that we're interested in, cut that population in half, and then we put it through some kind of a high throughput SNP genotyping using markers spread across the genome, and we very quickly identify individuals that have a higher proportion of the recurrent parent. Okay, so we're using background genome selection. This graph is just showing you that background genome selection works. At the first back cross, we can identify individuals that are full generation ahead. And so we do it, and we do that one more time, and we've got material that we can go to the field with. And the point of this graph here is that using different alleles from wild species, we can modulate the amount of beta carotene. We can go a little higher or a lot higher depending on our goals. Okay, and that's important because if we get it really high, the tomatoes are orange. Because of USDA marketing standards, you can't actually call an orange tomato a tomato if it's in a can. It has to be red. Okay. All right. I'm going to talk now just briefly about some genome resequencing that we've done, and this just walks you through the process. We create a library, put it on the sequencer, get the data back, and we assemble it relative to a reference genome. So for this project, what we did is we sequenced a pedigree. Okay, so everything that's circled in red, we sequenced, and the recurrent parent is essentially this Ohio 88119. For a number of the individuals in the pedigree, we had not full genome resequencing, but transcriptome data, but that was still useful to help sort out. I'm going to just focus on these two chromosomes because they're the most important for this study. If we look at SNP density relative to the reference genome, we can begin to identify regions that have integrations. Okay, and some of the important ones are boxed here. So there's a resistance gene here. Interestingly, this Ohio line, this 88119 on chromosome 5 was very different from the reference genome, okay, even though they're both cultivated processing type tomatoes. Okay, and this is a little snapshot of what breeding history does, and it turns out that the Heinz line and the Ohio line come out of pedigrees that use different Pimpinella foliums to create the processing background, and that's what we're seeing here. And then again, other integrations here. Now, there's one high-quality reference and then another reference for tomato that's of lower quality, but importantly, if we look at everything that we threw out of the first assembly, what we find is a lot of the unmapped reads in that first assembly actually map to Pimpinella folium. Okay, and so I think this gets at a point that a couple of the other speakers were making, is that if we're going to use a SNP platform, we may have to verify that the SNP is actually coming from where we think it might be. Okay, but the main point that I want to leave you with here is that the sequencing very clearly helps us identify integrations, and at least in this pedigree, the integrations that we're seeing are coming either from targeted breeding for disease resistance or are residual integrations from the process of creating processing tomatoes in the first place. Okay, and we can verify the origin of these through a phylogenetic approach used to identify the origin of each of those. And again, this is work that was done by Deb Leabouf, who's defending her thesis tomorrow. Okay, so I've already gone through the conclusions, but I think I've provided you information that supports each of these, and with that, I'm willing to take questions, and also I want to acknowledge funding from USDA, NIFA, for both SOLCAP and then follow-up grant.
The comments you make because of the diversity in the wild and domesticated is a little bit different. You have to do this crossing to reveal that diversity. Within the domesticated tomato species, is that enough to do some study, or what's the comment?
Yeah, so I think that if we're talking about like an association study to identify loci that are important for a specific trait, to me the issue is really can you actually correct for structure, and is it a relevant population? And then with tomato, there's a further issue of small effective population size, and so in some cases we may be actually considering something to be a true biological rep when it's actually just a rep, right, because of pedigree connectedness. But I think that in one has to work within the relevant germplasm pool, that the difference between a processing tomato and a fresh market tomato is too great in many cases for an association analysis to really correct for structure. Okay. And so I think, you know, I was pleased to see that in the DIFSTEEK presentation that pre-breeding was checked off in some of those boxes, because I think that if germplasm is really going to be useful, that utility is going to be revealed more effectively through pre-breeding than just association analysis.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Can you comment on why those introgressions may be persisting? I mean, are they decreasing in frequency in more radical time, or are they just drifting? Does that mean because birds are healthy?
Yeah, so in most cases they're persisting because of selection, right? I mean, they're selecting for genes, right? And so there's a linkage drag issue. And I mean, linkage drag is a real issue because of, it's an inbreeding species, and there are limited opportunities for recombination. And the difference, if we think about the difference between the Ohio line and the Heinz line that's a reference genome, that's probably persisting because of really it's a historical fingerprint, right? And we haven't completely shuffled the deck yet. Okay, there are a few intriguing places in the genome where, you know, I'm not going to say that there's heterosis, but there may be advantages to keeping that diversity. I'm not sure if I answered that question, but I suspect that we haven't had enough recombination to eliminate all of those.
Well, thank you very much, David.
Okay.